What a finish from Balogun.
Oh, Ben Yedda, beautifully done.
Bobby Young, surely. There it is.
Mbappe now. Wonderful.
Gotta be. Lovely finish.
Go for goal. Darren Mbappe.
It's Elie Wahi. Well, it's been coming.
Put in by Jonathan Davies. Kylian Mbappe brings the Parc des Princes to its feet.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Le Beau Jeu, your one-stop shop for all things French football. It's the official Ligue 1 Uber Eats podcast, and it is in English just for you. So we've rounded the final bend, and we're in to the final straight. 1 month left in the Ligue 1 season. What is there still up for grabs? What is there still left to lose? Coming up, we're going to have all the run-ins of the major players for European competition and have a look at those in danger of relegation as well. And speaking of relegation, we have a very special interview with FC Metz player Maxime Colin, who caught up with Andy Scott. Paris Saint-Germain and Olympique de Marseille are ensuring that the French flags will be flying in Europe in May. That is fantastic news for Ligue 1 clubs. We've got a cult player to profile as well. The man, the free kick man, and the legend Juninho, the former Olympic Lyonnais star and less successful director of football, shall we say. But his free kicks certainly live long in the memory. We're going to give you another chance to get your hands on that Terry Moffey Nice jersey with our Deja Who quiz. And so, without any further ado, to help me get through all of that and more, we have Paris-based football expert that you can catch on CBS, Jonathan Johnson. JJ, pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us once again.
Likewise. Thanks for having me on.
And we have the Côte d'Azur's very own freelance gun for hire. So we've managed to sign him up like one of the seven samurai. Luke Entwistle, great to have you on board for another episode.
I'm happy to be on again.
Excellent. It's been a while, Luke. We haven't seen you, I get the feeling. People have been missing your knitted jumpers and stuff, I get the feeling. But maybe I missed an episode as well, so maybe that's where I have the feeling that we haven't caught up for a while. But I'm looking forward to this.
I think we had Andreas hosting one, I was on for that. I think that was the end of the jumper, at least for this season. It'll be seen again as we go into October, I think, next year. So, yeah, a bit of an absence, a long period of absence for the jumper. I'm sad that you missed it that one time because you won't see it for a while.
Well, it is always nice in France when the jumpers go away for the season. It means that the sun is on its way. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, don't forget to leave us a review, spread the word as well, like, subscribe, follow, and recommend on all your podcast platforms. Well, let's start with a review of rounds 29 and 30 of the Ligue 1 season. Round 29 was a short one in the end because three matches were rescheduled and they're all coming up this coming Wednesday. So we'll have a look towards them as well. Later on in the show, we've got Lorient against Paris Saint-Germain, which could be a big one in the title race and the relegation race. Marseille take on Nice and Monaco against Lille. So some very, very big matches that are going to take place in midweek. But we did have a round of matches there. That was followed up just this weekend by match day 30 in the season as well. And gentlemen, we are seeing a little clearer now. JJ, we'll start with you and we'll start at the top. Paris Saint-Germain, 4-1 winners over Olympique Lyonnais, having missed out in that Lorient match, which was rescheduled, but it hasn't dampened their spirits. Obviously, we'll talk about the Barcelona triumph as well, but this was turning back the clock to, you know, a good old-fashioned win over a big rival in Olympique Lyonnais. There was no Mbappe, no Dembele. It was a special night for Marquinhos as well. Fin bon bref, as we say in French. There was plenty to talk about in this one.
Yeah, absolutely. Really interesting as well to see sort of the way that Luis Enrique's priorities have obviously clearly shifted now towards the Champions League. Such a great opportunity in front of PSG. I know we'll get to it, but you know, you'd have to say that they would really fancy themselves over two legs against Borussia Dortmund to get to the final now. You know, and I think you're seeing what we'll probably see now for the remainder of the season for PSG in Ligue 1, this ability to make wholesale changes to the team, but still, you know, get the results in convincing fashion. I mean, I think the thing that was most impressive about PSG against Lyon is how they really flew out of the traps, 2-0 up in basically 6 minutes, I think. Really, you know, completely threw Lyon for the entire game. And although Lyon got themselves back 1 when they were 3-0 down, you know, to find themselves 4-1 down at halftime, it was just a complete blitz from PSG. And I think you look at those two really well-worked Gonzalo Ramos goals as well. And it just seems like Luis Enrique has PSG sort of exactly where he wants them right now. I know there's a bit of debate about how he experimented with the starting 11 in the first leg against Barcelona, but you look at the way that he's keeping some of those key men fresh ahead of those two-legged semi-finals. You know, plus the fact that PSG may well now have the Ligue 1 title sewn up by midweek, depending on results. You know, it's all looking pretty good right now, as long as he can keep players fit and healthy. Obviously, a couple of players were got some rest because of suspension as well. So, no, it's looking, you know, cautiously optimistic for PSG and the way that things have fallen in place this season.
Luke, on individual performances, we saw an excellent Marquinhos against Barcelona as well, but he's a player that's come in for a little bit of criticism and always, you know, perhaps it's just the force of being there for 11 seasons and having been witness or part of so many disappointing moments for the club, particularly in Europe. But he seems to be really enjoying his football the last couple of weeks. Vitinha is almost a revelation this season. I mean, I was so devastated when Marco Verratti left, but Vitinha is like a Marco Verratti that scores goals now. Bradley Barcola is in exceptional form. Who stood out for you? And is this finally the Luis Enrique touch? Because we talk a lot about the team and a coach's impact on a team and getting Paris Saint-Germain to play with an identity. But a coach's job is also to bring the best out of individuals. And that's what we're seeing now.
Yeah, I mean, of the ones that you mentioned, and I think of the PSG team as a whole, I think it's Vitinha who really stood out. I think in Barcelona across both legs and then against Lyon as well. I watched him just for 5 minutes, just watching his movement in possession, even when he wasn't on the ball. But when PSG were in possession, seeing his movements, seeing how he looked. And, you know, obviously, Verratti was known as the owl, the weeboo, and the way that he kind of is always craning his neck around Verratti, looking around all the time, just perfectly aware of way he is relative to everyone else. And I think within a Luis Enrique system, that's so important. But I think we're seeing different facets of his game, different qualities now showing through. His composure, breaking the press when he's deep, you know, taking it past the player. I think he's really impressive, but also kind of very evocative of what the way Verratti was when he was at PSG. And there's been difficulty. I mean, I think for almost a decade, there were questions about PSG's recruitment in midfield and whether or not they had a complementary, you know, player alongside Verratti, or whether they could bring in someone of his quality to take away that burden of having to be the creator and the man in midfield to make things happen, to make things tick all the time. And it's now that he's, well, left. I mean, obviously, Vitinha came a year before Verratti left, but it's almost like they got his replacement ahead of time, is how it feels now. So, yeah, I've been really, really impressed with him because I think there were doubts, and I think there were well-founded doubts after his first season. I think it was a decent first season, but then it was a question of could he then kick on? And I think he's really done that. Marquinhos, I think what you say is quite fair about Marquinhos, the fact that, you know, his face almost as captain is very much tied to these failures in Europe in particular in recent years. And I think that maybe slightly dents his image on an individual collective basis, but maybe slightly unfairly so. The only kind of worrying performance, if you can say it, I think was maybe Colomwani, who obviously that huge price tag, I think it's kind of still weighing a little heavily on him. I think we've seen there's lots of talk about Ramos and Colomwani coming in for a combined 170 million euros, a huge fee. I think we've seen Ramos now kind of coming into his own in recent weeks. But I think Colomwani, maybe he'll be one of those players that we really see him shine next year, because obviously he showed at Nantes that he can thrive in this division for a much weaker team. So I'd expect a lot coming from him next season. But I think he's the only worrying, if you can say worrying, performer in this PSG side at the minute.
He also showed it in Germany and on the international stage at the World Cup, didn't he? We can also throw in someone like Ekitike there as well. I mean, Paris Saint-Germain have still spent a lot of money trying to find that eventual replacement for Kylian Mbappe. JJ, just before we leave Paris Saint-Germain, we talk about Vitinha, rightly so. He's catching the eye. Just a little point about the Ibu, the owl nickname for Marco Verratti. I didn't realize it was because he could turn his head 360 degrees. I thought it was just because he has these big owl eyes and, you know, was such a cute little 18-year-old when he first arrived at Paris Saint-Germain. He looked like a baby owl. But, yeah, maybe it was.
I'm definitely in the same boat as you, as I didn't realize it was the sort of swivel head movement like a Furby almost.
I did do an analysis, though, the last time. Remember when Kylian scored the hat-trick in Barcelona, the last time we played them in the Champions League? What was it, 3-1 there and 1-1 at home, I think?
No, 4-1 there in Paris, I think.
Yeah, everyone's still talking about the remontada as though they've exercised these demons. I thought, no, it was 4-0 away. That's right. It was 4-0 in Barcelona.
No, it was 4-1. I think Messi, that's scored, right, penalty. Messi scored in each game.
Kurzawa gave away the penalty. That's right. Exactly. So anyway, I did an analysis.
You can tell how far in the past it is if Kurzawa was playing recently.
And I did an analysis. And, you know, with the program, you can look and see where the players and freeze it and show their vision and all that sort of thing, computer graphics-wise. And we did it with Marco Verratti, who was involved, I think, in Kylian's first goal. And he does exactly that. It's literally looking around. When the ball's arriving, just before it's arriving at him, he's looking the other way to see where Mbappe is in the penalty box. So quite owl-like. The other midfielders I want to talk about, though, that, and JJ, I'll come to you on this, that I... So much talk about Warren Zaire-Emery. We've seen also Fabian starting to really perform. And what I like about those two is the fact that they're on the second tier, if you like. They're not catching the eye every time. Warren Zaire-Emery did that with a couple of goals last year, especially when he first burst onto the scene as a 16-year-old. But he and Fabian just have this strength about them of being fluid, and the oil, the cogs in the machine that are really stringing this whole thing together. And I think that's what's very impressive about them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Fabian Ruiz is quite underrated. And to be honest, I think he's been underrated for a number of years, even before he joined PSG. I mean, he had some very good years at Napoli before falling out of favor. You know, and I think he's really rediscovered that form. I mean, I remember when he first joined PSG, he had a string of really encouraging performances. And I think a lot of fans were really sort of hopeful that they'd found this new Thiago Motta-like figure. And I think that's part of the problem when you look at PSG and the midfield conundrum over the years. I think there was this over-obsession with wanting to recreate that brilliant midfield trio of Motta, Verratti and Matuidi, which was very, very difficult to replicate each one, you know, such a master at the different aspects of the game, which blended together perfectly. And PSG spent years trying to basically find replacements for Motta and Matuidi to build around Verratti, and it was just impossible. Obviously, there was a bit of midfield consistency in the days of Adrien Rabiot, but you know, it wasn't quite at the same level as the famous triumvirate. So, you know, I think it is really encouraging now to see that PSG have moved on from that, and that the midfield is once again quite quite functional. I mean, I think Warren Zaire-Emery, I'd say, is the sort of the glue that holds everything together. When he's not there, it does sometimes fall apart still, but the balance is almost perfect. I think when you've got Fabian, when you've got Warren Zaire-Emery, and when you've got Vitinha, that seems to really work. The one person who's really lost out, I think, and I was actually half wondering if he might start in the second leg against Barcelona, is Ugarte, because it's almost like Luis Enrique's system has moved away from the need to have sort of a destroyer in midfield who sort of breaks up the play and allows PSG to get back on the ball. Like, their dominance is almost, you know, so sort of superior at times against some of their opponents that they don't even need that sort of kind of profile on the pitch that often. And that itself, I think, has been a real source of pride for Luis Enrique, that they've managed to move away to that. And their mastery of the games now is just so much better. But it's true. I do think that Fabian Ruiz is a very underrated player in that midfield trio.
Well, you talk about how Paris Saint-Germain have evolved, how good they are playing at the moment, that they don't need a destroyer in the middle of the park. They could be crowned Ligue 1 champions yet again for a record 12th time on Wednesday evening. So make sure you listen to this pod. Don't put it aside. Listen to it straight away, because otherwise it might be too late. If Monaco fail to win against Lille in their match, in their postponed match on Wednesday night in Paris Saint-Germain. As expected, pick up all 3 points against relegation-threatened Lorient. That would leave Paris Saint-Germain with a 14-point gap over second place with just 12 points left on offer. So they would be crowned champions. Paris Saint-Germain, they don't have the toughest run-in either. They have Le Havre, then Toulouse, Nice. That match has been rescheduled, of course, after Lorient first up. Lorient on Wednesday, then Le Havre, Toulouse, Nice in midweek, and then the final match of the round, Metz. So apart from perhaps Nice there, otherwise there's not too much resistance, at least on paper, in those final five matches of the season for Luis Enrique's men. It is certainly the opportunity to focus on the Champions League, and we're going to have a deep dive into that in a couple of moments' time. Guys, now we're going to look at the not exactly trailing pack, the peloton, if you like, just behind Paris Saint-Germain, who aren't going to be able to stop Paris Saint-Germain from winning the title, but can still qualify for Champions League football. I want to have a look with five or four matches left for these remaining teams. Who do we think is going to finish where? So it's a bold prediction time, which we know our fans like to, listeners like to hear and then throw back at us. So, Luke, we'll start with you first on the Côte d'Azur. Monaco in second place. They have that game in hand coming up against Lille. It's going to be a tough one. They've just beaten Brest in a massive result in the weekend. Denis Zakaria scoring a fantastic goal as well. They did, however, finish with two red cards, Ben Seguir and Singo as well. So they'll be out in midweek, and perhaps, who knows, a little bit longer. Violent conduct charges can bring an extra match or two with them. They have Lyon after their match against Lille. It's Lyon, Clermont, Montpellier, and Nantes, so not the most challenging either. A couple of perhaps banana skins in there, but where do you think Monaco are going to finish? Have they done enough now?
I think that the game against Lille, I think, completely decides their season at this point. I think that should they get a victory, they're going to be assured of the podium and I think likely second place. Because you've seen, and we'll maybe go on to Brest, but you see Brest dropping off slightly at this point. I think they get a result potentially against Lille, and if they get one against Lyon as well, those last three games are pretty easy, all against relegation threatened sides, or notably sides that are now putting themselves out of the relegation conversation, like Montpellier and Nantes. These are sides that will have nothing to play for at this part of the season. What you want to be playing is not the teams right at the bottom, but the teams that are 12th, 13th, 14th, because those are the teams that you can question their motivation. So I think second. I think that if they get a result against Lille, I think they're pretty much guaranteed of second. But I think regardless of the result on Wednesday, they'll finish on the podium, which of course will get them automatic qualification for the Champions League.
That's right. It's the top three that qualify automatically for this new... do I say new and improved? New Champions League, at least, coming up next season, this massive 36-team league, which is going to be quite the difficult one to slice up in various ways. It's 10 matches each, isn't it? 10 group game matches or 8? I think it's 10 group game matches each for each team.
Yeah, it's slightly more. It's around that.
Yeah. Well, it's more than the 6 group stage matches that we have already. That's for sure. Before it goes into a traditional last 16 quarterfinals, so there will be more Champions League football on the way next season. JJ, will it be Monaco and Brest in third place? Because Brest have been in second for so long, but they've been knocked off by a fast finishing Monaco. They've lost their last two in a row. Are these the cracks starting to form? Because Lyon overpowered them last weekend, and then this weekend it was a 2-0 loss to Monaco. They take on Rennes, Nantes, Reims and Toulouse, so a couple of Brittany derbies, or just about, in the case of Nantes there as well. Can they hold on? Because behind them, Lille are coming home strong as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, having seen Lille up close last week, I think the feeling for me is that Lille will be very, very strong over the final few weeks of the season now that they don't have Europe to consider. So if I was to put money on anyone at the moment, I think I'd be going for Monaco second and Lille coming in third, with Brest probably dropping down to fourth. And I think the most important thing to remember as well, it's been a phenomenal season so far for Brest, one of the best stories in Europe, let alone in France. But I think there always was going to be an element of sort of coming back to reality. And I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that even for Brest, even if they were to finish fourth, maybe even fifth, although I think fourth is probably a good bet at this moment in time, given that it's sort of 6 points between fifth and third. I think that's still a fantastic achievement, for this team and for Eric Waugh, who's done a phenomenal job. We've waxed lyrical about him at times so far this season. And I don't think that dropping from second to fourth should sort of lessen what Brest have achieved at all. I think it's phenomenal that they're in this chat. And obviously fourth place would be a qualification spot for the Champions League group stages as well. So, I think that would be a phenomenal story, even if Brest were to go into the Europa League next season. I'm very much excited and hopeful that they will sort of confirm their European adventure for next year. But I think in terms of the top three, my feeling now for Brest is that they probably will just about drop out. So, I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see how that Monaco and Lille game plays out, because like I said, I think Lille are really going to come home strong. And if they can get an upset win, then who knows, maybe they could even snatch a second spot. But my feeling for now is that it's probably going to be Monaco and Lille completing the top three.
Just on Brest, you kind of referenced the 4-3 incredible game against Lyon, but the week before that, there's an incredible 4-3 against Metz as well. And it just feels as though Eric Waugh, at the run-in, has just decided to completely change almost the philosophy of the play. They've been very solid, but they've suddenly just started playing Satriano and Meunier together, which is something they've not done all season, completely altering the balance of the team. They're scoring way more goals, but they're also conceding a lot more goals. Previously, the strongest, one of the very strongest defences in the league. And now suddenly you've conceded, I think they've conceded 9, it is in their last three. That's so out of kilter with what they've been like all season. There's been, a few comments as well from Eric Waugh kind of targeting referees, kind of mm-hmm. going for this very Sir Alex Ferguson, everyone's against us kind of mentality, which is not quite working at the minute. So I wonder if they'll revert to type as in this little run-in just to try and preserve that third place, go with the single striker, refine your defensive solidity, maybe a few, a few fewer media declarations, kind of targeting referees and what like. And if they can just kind of rediscover that form that they have had so consistently, ridiculously consistently throughout the season.
Well, there's a team who's been ridiculously consistent in not scoring and conceding very few, but conceding more than they did in the first half of the season, who are in fifth place at the moment. Perhaps their saving grace is that Lens have struggled in recent weeks as well to try and catch them. But if we accept that the top four are in our bold prediction, and Luke, do you agree that Lille will catch Brest and overtake them for that third place?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, so I think we all suspect that Lille are just coming home too strong. Fifth place is Nice. They're on 47 points. As JJ said, they're 6 points behind Brest, 5 points behind Lille, 1 point ahead of Lens. Now, Luke, Nice is again in your neck of the woods. They scored 3 goals for the first time at home in Ligue 1 this season, but it was against Lorient. So do we take this, with a little grain of salt as well? Because Lorient are one of a few sides in free fall, particularly in the second half of the season. They've got Marseille, Strasbourg, Le Havre, who are a side that are fighting for their survival. Marseille is a big derby match. Then they've got Paris Saint-Germain. Perhaps the fact that Paris Saint-Germain has now been postponed and is after that Champions League semi-final tie against Borussia Dortmund may have an impact. And then Lille. So they have a tough run. Can they hold on there? Because there are teams behind them, well, Lens in particular, who will be coming for them. They want European football again, Lens.
I think it's going to be quite difficult for them, but I think there's reason for a bit of optimism, notably that they've kept two clean sheets. As you say, their strength has always been their defence. It's been Tadebo, Dante, Bard as well, who everyone always questions every year, Bard, whether or not they'll sign a replacement. I think this is the year in which he said, no, I am starting left back here and I deserve the spot. And I think he's been incredible. I think he's had a very, very good season. So I think the fact that they have kept two clean sheets, they've looked a lot more solid, with the asterisk that, you know, it is Lorient who have looked really poor in recent weeks. I think that bodes really, really well for them. I can see them potentially just about holding on. I wonder if, Luca Elsner is not in a position to do Nice any favours, but he's from Nice. It's his city, it's his club. Lots of Nice fans, I know, you know, hold Elsner in very high regard and wish Le Havre well, but he will not be able to give out any free gifts in this running, because they're really now mired in a relegation battle. And that last game of the season against Lille looks really, really tough. You know, maybe Lille have already secured their top three spots at that point, and there will be a bit of relâchement then. They will have, you know, taken the foot off the pedal a little bit, but it's a difficult run in. But what gives me optimism is the fact that they are keeping clean sheets again. They have scored three goals at home for the first time all season, which is quite incredible. Notably, it's you know, the game that I wasn't there. I've barely missed a game all season, and the one that I'm not there, they've decided to put on a bit of an offensive showing. So yeah, I think they could just hold on, but if they are to do so, it'll be because of their defense, not because they're going to suddenly start scoring three every game between now and the end of the season.
JJ, outside of that, depending on the cup final, because Paris Saint-Germain take on Olympique Lyonnais on the 25th of May in the Coupe de France final, and that could just free up another European spot in the standings. Is there a miracle for Rennes or Olympique Lyonnais, who are down in 7th and 8th place? They're 4 and 5 points respectively behind Lens, who are in 6th. Who do you expect to come in sort of that 6, 7, 8 place, if we overlook the likes of Reims and Marseille, who are after that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're sort of at the point now where you look at it and you think that Marseille are probably better off going to try and win the whole thing and get themselves back into Europe as opposed to try and get themselves into the reckoning in the league. But I'm glad you mentioned sort of the possibility of, if PSG win the Coupe de France against Lyon, you know, they have the opportunity to gift sort of 7th place as a European qualification spot to Ligue 1, which could be Lyon, but also might not be. So, you know, that's kind of an interesting subplot to keep an eye on as well with Lyon in their final games. Like, are they going to be in and around 7th spot? Because if they're not, then it really is an extra motivation for them to beat PSG in that Coupe de France final. But for me, I think if I was to pick one team that could close the gap, I would probably go for Rennes. But you know, based on what we've just said, I would probably feel more comfortable saying that Rennes will score more points over the remainder of the season than Nice. And again, Nice have an extra point on Lens, so I'm not sure it's going to be enough. So perhaps, you know, Rennes will be the beneficiaries of that 7th spot as long as PSG can win the Coupe de France final. But I think the team who are now in a really tough position in terms of getting that European spot are Lyon, where it's simple in a way because they know that if they beat PSG in the Coupe de France final, they will qualify. But equally, it's going to be quite tough for them to maneuver themselves any higher than 7th now for the remainder of this season. And to be honest, for them to even get to that point, given how awful the start to the season was, is quite an achievement, to be fair to Serge and the players. So yeah, it's I think this is probably going to be the most fascinating aspect, I think, of the race to qualify for Europe over the last couple of weeks.
He has come out in an interview in L'Equipe last week and said that even his friends call him Stone Wise as a nickname, Pierre Serge. So
didn't he have that press conference a couple of weeks ago where he called himself the Wish version of Pep Guardiola or something like that?
Yes, he did.
Well, you've got to have confidence when you're a coach at the very top. But good on him. He has done a remarkable job turning Olympique Lyonnais around. Can he turn around what was essentially a 4-1 defeat in the dress rehearsal of the cup final last night against Paris Saint-Germain in time to qualify for Europe via the cup? And of course, that's not the only motivation. Winning the French Cup, the country's oldest footballing competition, is of course a great honour in itself. We're going to have a look down the bottom of the table in a couple of moments' time. But next up, we have a very special feature. So as we've mentioned, the season is drawing to its inevitable climax. The situation towards the bottom of the table is getting tighter and tighter as well. Top flight survival is so important to all these clubs, but particularly FC Metz and Laszlo Bologna's side are one of the sides who are duking it out to beat the drop. Our man Andy Scott sat down for a chat with Le Growlies right back, Maxime Collin, who recently returned from a long spell in England, where he was with Brentford and then Birmingham City. He discusses his cross-channel experiences, which included playing alongside a young Jude Bellingham, the derby with his boyhood club Lens, and of course, the deadly game of musical chairs that's underway to beat the drop. Take it away, Andy.
Metz have earned a reputation as the ultimate yo-yo club with no fewer than 14 relegations or promotions in the 21st century. So I asked Maxime Collin about the possibility of yet another relegation at the end of this campaign and trying to avert that danger.
Well, yeah, I just arrived at the club in August, so I wasn't there, obviously, for this promotion and relegation, like you said. But yeah, it's a very strong club. It's like the town, they really love football. You can really see that, for example, now we just got promoted and we got a full house every weekend, or not so much a full house, but we've got a very good support. So it's a very town of football, so you can see that there is something behind this club. But then, yeah, obviously, when you get a promotion, then it's very hard to stay. You've got a lot of politics, a lot of choice to be made by the board, it's a club who get promoted, get relegated. That's the most harder, the most difficult thing. It's to stay in the league, I guess. So yeah, it's a shame. It's a shame that it happened like that. And yeah, hopefully we can break this bad record.
What makes it so frustrating for Metz fans is that this is a club with a remarkable history, from beating Barcelona in the Carabao Cup in the 1980s to having players like Robert Pires, Emmanuel Adebayor and Sadio Mane. That history surely then has an impact on those signing for the club now.
Yeah, no, I knew about the club, but to be fair, I'm a bit surprised in a good way. How good the town is. The town is really a town of football, so people really like the club. And like I said, it's really a town of football. It reminds me a lot about Lens, because I'm from the north of France, and it's a bit the same. It's very nice, because you can feel the support of the club, and I think that's very. Why it's a very historic club as well, because behind you always had a town who's following you. So you know, it's very a strong club, and with a very good the stadium is very nice, the training ground is very nice, all around it. It's very a League One club. So yeah, you just need to find the recipe to stay in the league and establish yourself, because everything else around the club, it's really League One. So it deserves to be and to stay there.
Collin is steeped in football thanks to his upbringing in the far north of France around Lens, and Lens is a club that is dear to his heart.
Yeah, so I've been to my high school. I've been 3 years in Lens, so I know the town very well. I know a lot of players from there as well. So I've always been around the club, always in the young team, always playing against Lens. I know really well. I used to train at the training ground as well for 3 years. So yeah, it's really I love the surrounding around the club. Like people, there is nothing much to do in around Lens. So yeah, the club has got a massive part of their life. You can see the atmosphere, and when they chant les corons as well at halftime, it's very emotional for everyone. So yeah, no, the It's well known in France to be one of the best stadium in France, and for such a small team as Lens, what the club represents for the town. It's huge because it's not really a big town, but the club is quite big in France. So yeah, it's really represent a lot for the people. I'm proud of that. It's a bit funny for me because I'm the other side. It's always a nice game that I really look forward for it. Yeah,
Colin only returned to France last year after almost a decade spent abroad, mainly in England, played in the Championship, Brentford, and then Birmingham City. And he admits that time has shaped him as a player and as a person.
Yeah, so it's funny because coming back to France, I would have think, I'm French, so it would be easy to come back. But it wasn't as easy as I thought. I was even in Belgium before, so nine years out of France. Yeah, you've got to readapt to the way of living in France. A lot of English people used to say, French people are a bit rude, and I didn't really get that the first time I arrived to England. I didn't get why they said that, because as well, coming from Lens and the north of France, it's not really the part of France where people are usually rude.
So where are people rude?
Coming back now to France, now I can feel the sense of why English people are saying that to about French people in general. So, but Metz is also a mining town as well, a bit like Lens as well. So it's definitely not rude people here. But it's a bit funny to now coming back to France after a long period. Yeah, I can finally understand this saying.
Among his former teammates at Birmingham was a certain Jude Bellingham, who's gone on to become one of the biggest stars in world football.
Yeah, you kind of knew already that he would be a big one, but then you obviously know how high he's going to go. I used to play against with Yuri Tillmans as well. He's in Anderlecht. He was pretty much the same level guy, like very mature, very young age. Playing, he was as well. Yuri was playing a Champions League game as well at 16, and so they're very mature at the age. And Jude Bellingham was exactly like that. Like he was 16 years old, but he was talking like he was already a man, and he was also playing like he was a man. So he understood very early what it was to be a football player and to what it required to be the best. So his mentality was already very, very good at and very, very top at 16. So obviously then after his ability come on top of that, and that's where you can see that he just keep going high and high and high. And you could see straight away that from his mentality, he had the right mentality. So you're thinking, okay, if he keeps this mentality and he's going to a bigger club, then he's going to stay the same and keep growing and growing and growing. It's what happened. So yeah, I'm not surprised at all. He's still very, very hungry for, like, he's not thinking, oh, I just arrived in Real Madrid and that's enough for me. No, I think he wants to be Ballon d'Or. He wants to be the best. He wants to win a major trophy with England. He wants to be the, and as well, now he developed as well a very leadership as well. So yeah, he's got all the tools to be a big one in the future as much as he's already now.
Back at Metz, Collin is now playing with more exciting young talents, in particular the Georgian striker Georges Mikautadze and the Senegal midfielder Lamine Camara.
Yeah, no, they've got a very good ability, like physical and technical. They're very, like, they've got it all as well. So the difference is going to be made on the mentality. Are they going to have the right mentality for to make a very, very good career, or are they going to just be because of their ability? They're always going to be around, but the difference between being good and being the top are going to be the mentality. So it's going to be up to them. If they choose the right path, I would say. But you know, the ability, they definitely got it. So they've got the potential, yeah, to be very big. Yeah.
So we should note very quickly that that interview was done before Metz won that match in the 1998 Championatico against Lens. Of course, that replay where Lens pipped them to the 1998 Ligue 1 title. And then they followed it up with a win over Le Havre this weekend as well. So that interview done before those two big games. But Luke, Metz, they are showing a little bit of life, a little bit of a pulse where we thought perhaps there was none. Miko Tadze has just brought up double figures as well for goals after his on-again, off-again move with Ajax and then back, and now he's here, and it took him a little bit of time to settle back in, but he's finding the back of the net regularly now. Are Metz showing enough to survive the drop?
I think, you know, lots of these teams towards the bottom have got one player who is just driving them towards safety. You know, you think about Montpellier, you think about Teji Savanier and the incredible impact that he's had at that club, and how they have gone from a pretty, not quite a desperate situation, but not far off either, and have then brought themselves out of trouble. And of course, that's Miko Tadze there. I think what's incredible, I've seen a couple of stats, one of which he's involved in 41% of all of Metz's goals this season, despite the fact that he spent half of the season at Ajax. And he scored 10. That's, you know, seven more than Metz's next top scorer, Mathieu Udol. And I think that those numbers are just incredible. And it does really show. I mean, I don't like to use the term because it's never fully true, but a one-man team Metz have become in recent weeks. Because really, if Metz do achieve safety, and you know, they're currently in 15th, so currently on track to do so, they will do so thanks to Miko Tadze. And I think it's a real testament to his kind of character as well to bounce back from that time at Ajax. I noticed he did an interview with the keeper over the weekend saying that it was really difficult there. You know, he said he was going mad. He was just in a hotel room. Ajax didn't really help him find an apartment, couldn't bed in, didn't speak the language. And to kind of bounce back from that, you know, barely played whilst he was in the Eredivisie, but to come back, as you say, needed a few games to get back into it, but to hit the scoring form that he has in recent weeks in a poor or underperforming Metz side and to drag them almost single-handedly towards safety. I think that's quite an incredible achievement. So I'd give them a good chance of staying up. And if they do so, it's thanks to one man, really.
Well, he's not the only player that's struggled at Ajax this year as well. I think PSV have nearly doubled Ajax's points in the Eredivisie. So it's a rare thing when you see Ajax being walloped around the country in the Dutch first division. JJ, Metz, we know when you're in the relegation hot tub that there are so many points that you're not going to win against those at the top of the table, but you have to beat your direct rivals. And that's exactly what Metz did on the weekend, that win 1-0 over Le Havre. And this Le Havre side, I mean, Luke just spoke about Elsner, but this Le Havre side is a team that impressed so much in the first half of the season. They were back in the top flight. They were trying to play their football. They're a real side that breathes the identity of Le Havre as well. The port town that, you know, these kids trying to that grew up playing football on the streets. There's so much of that about this Le Havre side. And I guess they play up to the romance of it. But, you know, it is the club's identity. And now they are really struggling. I think that's one win in their last 12. For the first time this season, they're in the playoff position as well, in 16th place. You know, this is not looking good for them. Are they going to survive? I guess there's one saving grace, is that below them, it's looking even worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think going back to Luke's point about Metz, you know, when you have a player in the goal-scoring form that Miko Tadze is in, I mean, that counts for so much. But the thing that I think is really going to decide who ultimately drops down and, you know, perhaps sees a bit of salvation in the potential playoff spot is whoever has the easiest schedule. Because I'm, you know, looking at some of the teams who might drop down into there. I mean, you're looking at Nantes having really bad time of things at home, but actually have three of their games away over the remainder of the season. I mean, Metz, you actually would probably think that their salvation would lie in that game away at Strasbourg or the game at home to PSG when you assume that the title is well and truly wrapped up. Because otherwise, when you've got Lille and Rennes both playing for something, that's going to be tough. Like you said, you've got to win the points against the teams that are sort of in and around you, and they've done that. But now they're kind of running out of fixtures against some of those teams sort of in a similar area to them. I mean, I think Le Havre, Strasbourg at home maybe, but it's another really, really tough run of games. I mean, they've got PSG, Nice and Marseille. I mean, possibly Marseille, depending on whether or not they've managed to secure a European spot by the end of it, depending on whether they're going to the final. But it's really not going to be easy. And to be honest, I think the best case scenario, my feeling, is Lavre finishing in that playoff spot. And that playoff is not going to be easy either. I mean, you look at the teams, that are sort of in and around the top of Ligue 2 at the moment. It's gotten a bit tighter recently with Auxerre dropping a few points, but you've got Angers, you've got Saint-Étienne. None of those games are going to be easy for a team like Lavre or Lorient. And for me, I feel like it's going to be between one of those two, with Clermont pretty much as good as being gone already. But Metz, I think they almost need just three more points to make sure of it. And not assuming that they can make the most of the fact that their games are away instead of home, I think they'll take themselves out of the equation as well. So for me, I think the best case scenario for Lavre is that they finish in that playoff spot, which, like I said, is not necessarily a good thing when you look at the teams that they could come up against.
Well, it's Auxerre who are leading the way in Ligue 2 at the moment, but still five matches to go there. They've got a three-point lead over Angers in second place, and then Saint-Étienne 1 point further back.
I don't know if you guys caught it over the weekend, but Saint-Étienne, it was going into about a handful of minutes of added time, and Cardona, who obviously had a penchant for scoring spectacular goals with Brest, didn't work out for him over the first half of the season against Augsburg. But I urge you to check out his winning goal for Saint-Étienne and the scenes that followed at Geoffroy Guichard. It's phenomenal to have the poise that he had to lift it over the goalkeeper and the defenders to score the winner in really, really tense circumstances. It's absolutely brilliant. And the celebrations, it's phenomenal. I think I speak for many in the French football community and sort of crossing my fingers that we have the Giants, the Green Giants, back in Ligue 1 sooner rather than later.
And also fantastic, JJ, you're right to point out, great to see fantastic, joyous scenes at Saint-Étienne, full stop, because most of the memory for people that we last saw them sort of exiting the top flight was with some absolutely scandalous scenes around the penalty shootout. Was that for relegation or promotion? That was for promotion, wasn't it, already?
That was Auxerre.
Yeah, that was Auxerre. That's right.
Coming up.
Exactly. Yeah. So in the playoff, I mean, they were crazy scenes. So great to see a bit of positivity around Les Verts. Luke, JJ, we've heard from what he thinks is going to happen. Do you think there's any chance for Lorient? I'm assuming we all agree that Clermont and their, you know, soon to be finished stadium is going to be unveiled in Ligue 2, and that Lorient perhaps can try and wrestle their way out of that, or is that a lost cause as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone will agree that Clermont are down. I mean, it seems that they've already started rebuilding. I mean, you mentioned the new stadium. It's quite it's kind of a metaphor, I think, for where Clermont are. You know, they've already brought in a new manager essentially for next season. They've got him, brought him in as an assistant to Pascal Gastien. He'll take over next season. So with the new stadium as well. So I think it's an image of a club that is not quite starting from scratch, but like, you know, looking to reconstruct itself after a really difficult season. But to have stayed in Ligue 1 for 3 years that they have on the shoestring budget that they are on, I think it's quite spectacular, really. And I think Gastien, who I think will take his retirement or, you know, maybe move to a backroom kind of role at Clermont at the end of the season, I think that he deserves great credit for having kept them up in that time, even if this season has been, you know, not their best, shall we put it. I think Lorient will also finish 17th. And I mean, I think that Nantes are actually safe now. I'm kind of ruling them out of that conversation. But yeah, I think it's still between Metz and Lavre. I think Lavre are stronger collectively, but as we've already referenced, having a player who can single-handedly score the goals to get you out of trouble, I think that can make the difference. So it's between this kind of collective strength and Georges Mikatadze that this relegation battle between Lavre and Metz will play out.
Well, to check out all the highlights from the weekend's action, head straight to our official YouTube channel at Ligue 1 Uber Eats for all the match highlights, top goals, compilations, behind-the-scenes saves, everything every week in English, or if you want to practice in French as well. Subscribe on there and get your notifications as soon as something drops. Time to head, gentlemen, to the moment we've all been waiting for, particularly, well, perhaps a little more JJ and myself, Luke, only because you are not a self-diagnosed Paris Saint-Germain supporter or former season ticket holder as we both were. But JJ, it's not the first time, obviously, we've mentioned that we've beaten Barcelona since the remontada, but there is a feeling around. I mean, people have very short memories. This Paris Saint-Germain side, over two legs, was too strong. And, you know, they almost did it without Kylian Mbappe, particularly from the first leg. What did you make of the two legs? And, you know, the first leg was tough, but they went and did the business, did the job in Barcelona. How did you see the entire tie over 180 minutes?
Yeah, I mean, really, really, really interesting one. I mean, I think Barcelona deserved a lot of credit for their performance in the first leg. I think they were better than many people expected. I mean, I think the first leg really was decided on Luis Enrique, you know, having one of his sort of tinkering moments where he changed a few too many things in the starting 11, which didn't necessarily make sense. Obviously, he was left short at right back and was forced to play Marquinhos there. But some of the other decisions, like when he changed sort of certain pre-match choices, like bringing Warren Zaire-Emery in, that sort of stuff, Bradley Barcola. I mean, Barcola, I think, you know, you look at his second half in the first leg and then his, you know, 77 minutes or whatever it was on the pitch in the second leg made a phenomenal difference. But I think there's moments as well in the first leg where PSG played well enough that they could have at least drawn the game. I mean, obviously there's that sliding doors moment where Dembele hits the post, and if he puts that in, PSG actually go back ahead 3-2, I think, or they go 3-1 up, possibly something like that. But yeah, it was one of those where, you know, I think PSG overall deserved it, but I think the way that they did it in the second leg was, you know, really, really impressive. You know, making history, not just sort of pulling off a remontada, you know, which really fully and truly exercises the demons of 2017. But, you know, I think as well, you know, making history, I think they're the first team in 25 attempts to overturn a first leg home loss in a quarterfinal, which, you know, is pretty impressive. And I think as well, you know, Luis Enrique to sort of have been the architect of remontada and then to inflict that on Barcelona is quite quirky as well. So I think PSG overall, you know, superb. You look at some of the individual performances, Dembele, Vitinha, and yeah, you're right. You know, Mbappe basically sort of woke up for the final half an hour of the second leg, scored two goals, but, you know, didn't necessarily contribute as much as, you know, some other people did. And I'm glad you mentioned Marquinhos earlier in the show, having a superb performance. I think if he doesn't make some of those late blocks in the second leg in Barcelona, you know, it could have been a different story. But, you know, some interesting individual performances as well. Donnarumma, shaky as ever, not particularly convincing. But overall, I think PSG, you know, when they are able to turn it on, look very, very good.
Interesting you say Luis Enrique was the architect of the remontada, not Deniz Aytekin, the referee, which is the one I certainly associate most with Barcelona's remontada. But perhaps Barcelona fans are feeling that boot is on a different foot as well. Maybe they can't find that. How many million was it they were paying the referees in Spain every season? Anyway, let's not go there for that one. Luke, Donnarumma, he does look shaky for a player that when he signed for Paris Saint-Germain was considered the best goalkeeper in the world. He just won the Euro with Italy and played a decisive role in that when he arrived at Paris Saint-Germain. He had never played Champions League football before he arrived in France because AC Milan, like much of Italian football, was trying to claw its way back to the top in Europe. He has been tested. There's no doubt that on his day, he is a fantastic goalkeeper. He is a man mountain. He fills almost two-thirds of the goal, which is already intimidating for a striker coming at him. But is he a potential weakness heading into this semi-final against Borussia Dortmund?
Yeah, it's quite interesting because, you know, as you say, Donnarumma came in as a European champion at PSG, player of the tournament during that Euros in 2021. So he was Italy's key performer. I think the problem, and there's an interesting kind of maybe subplot here, is it's against Borussia Dortmund. PSG have been strongly linked with Gregor Kobel, Borussia Dortmund's goalkeeper, as a potential replacement. And, you know, I think there is reason to look elsewhere, even if I think that in terms of shot stopping, which I think is still a pretty good measure of a good goalkeeper, you'd still put him in the top three, top five goalkeepers in the world, I think pretty unquestionably. But it's everything around that. And the problem is that he burst onto the scene, this, you know, incredible, physically imposing 16-year-old goalkeeper at AC Milan. But he burst onto the scene as, you know, as a player with a few weaknesses. And the problem is that those weaknesses have not been worked on, notably being imposing within his own box in terms of his distribution, his balls out from the back. Those two elements in particular are still like major, major flaws, I think, in his game. And I think that it's not necessarily shown up in Ligue 1, but when it comes to those big, big games that come around 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 games a year, I think that there is a lack of confidence. I think that he is still very much aware, and he should be aware, because these will be the things that the goalkeeper coach at PSG will be going through with him every single day at training. So I think there will be a self-awareness that I have these weaknesses, that I need to work on these weaknesses. But I think there's a lack of confidence. I think there's a crisis of confidence when it comes to these big matches. I know that I'm weak in these sectors, and he quite frequently gets exposed for his weaknesses in these sectors. So I think that there is reason potentially to look elsewhere, especially for Luis Enrique, who is, you know, so insistent that you have to be good with the ball at your feet, that you have to play out from the back, that you have to be more competent in this facet. So I think that there could be a question come the end of the season, but nobody's questioning his shot stopping ability. Absolutely incredible in that regard, but it's the rest of it that I think is the problem.
JJ, Borussia Dortmund obviously has to bring back good memories for Paris Saint-Germain supporters from the last time they played. It was 2020 early on. And for the story, I mean, it was remarkable. I was in Dortmund for the first leg, where Haaland scored a couple of sensational goals. It was a 2-1 win for Borussia Dortmund in front of 70,000 or 66,000, I think, when there was no standing for Champions League matches in the yellow wall. But Paris Saint-Germain brought it back. Then came COVID. No fans inside the stadiums. Paris Saint-Germain had to play in that empty ground, but with thousands and thousands of supporters outside the ground. Those incredible scenes with Neymar and Juan Bernat scoring the goals, a 2-0 victory to send them through. You talk about Marquinhos' blocks against Barcelona, that image of him celebrating the final whistle as Haaland walks past is a incredible adrenaline-filled moment. And you can tell that I just watched it earlier today, the highlights as well, because it was a special match for Paris Saint-Germain. They went all the way to the final that year, even though they met Dortmund in the last 16 that year. But can they do it again? And does this suggest that, yes, then comes the final, and in a final, anything can happen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think PSG will be buoyed as well by the fact that they beat Dortmund earlier in the season in the group stage and then drew away. So they didn't, although Dortmund finished ahead of them in the group, they didn't lose to them. And I think as well, going back to sort of what happened a couple of years ago, it kind of felt like very much sort of an end of the world party. I think there's quite a lot of different subplots I remember from those two games. I think there was that Haaland thing where he's like meditating or something like that in his celebration, and then the PSG players had some fun with that. I think there was a party as well after they'd lost the first leg, and I think, remember, got Navas and Cavani shouting, "This is how you win the Champions League." And obviously, although it didn't look like it was conducive to that at the time, it was the season where PSG ended up going all the way to the final and then losing narrowly to Bayern Munich. But I think my overriding memory of that Dortmund second leg, actually more so than the communion with the fans, was a fantastically concentrated display from Neymar. Obviously there's not too many really fond memories of his time with PSG, but I think that run, his individual performances in that run to the Champions League final, which he managed to maintain despite the break for COVID, was phenomenal. I remember him being completely focused, and although he wasn't necessarily prolific in those games, just his play and the role that he played technically in the successes that led PSG all the way to the Champions League final then was superb, and it arguably started at Parc des Princes against Dortmund. So I think, yes, there will be fond memories of that. But also I think you know, Dortmund, based on what PSG will have seen from them already, I don't think PSG will be too fearful of what they've seen from Dortmund on the pitch. I mean, they'll know that obviously Dortmund are able to turn it on in front of their own crowd and look at what they did against Atletico Madrid. But I think a huge advantage for PSG is that the first leg will be played in Germany. So if they can keep it tight or get away with a narrow defeat, you know, they definitely can turn it around at home.
Luke, Paris Saint-Germain won't be the only team flying the French flag in the semi-finals of European Cup competition in a couple of weeks' time. Marseille overcame a 2-1 loss to Benfica in Lisbon in the second leg. They had to dig deep. It wasn't easy, but in the end, Faris Moumbagna, who scored a fantastic equaliser against Toulouse on the weekend, make sure you check out that on the Ligue 1 Uber Eats YouTube channel. He was there again, getting on the end of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang's cross to get that precious, precious 1-0 win. And then, of all players to miss in the penalty shootout, Angel Di Maria, the World Cup winner, missing the penalty, doing Marseille the big favour, and Marseille did the business. Now, the big question is for them, can they go on and do it against an Atalanta side, who, of course, claimed the biggest scalp of all in the Europa League, Liverpool?
I think they're capable of doing it. I almost wonder if Liverpool would have been a friendlier tie for Marseille. You know, the atmosphere at Anfield, how huge an atmosphere it would have been at the Velodrome too. And just, you know, there's a narrative going on at Liverpool, isn't there, with, you know, Klopp leaving. I just wonder if Marseille, slightly chaotic club, might have melded better with, you know, such a tie rather than against Atalanta, who maybe a slightly less Hollywood tie, but extremely well organised, have looked really good. You know, Gasperini, there's been a couple of highs and lows during his time as manager there, but he's really got them playing at their best again, as they were a few seasons ago. Maybe not quite the exact same attacking juggernaut all the time, but a really solid side. And I think that it will be a difficult tie. I thought against Benfica across the two ties, I think they maybe just shaded it, Marseille, but it wasn't the most high quality tie. And I'm talking about both sides here, and there are big mitigating factors for Marseille with all of those injuries, especially in defence. I know that Gigo was playing with injections to allow him to play through the pain. And Mbemba, you know, he's got an injury. He's kind of in and out. No Quentin Merlin, who is out. Bamba Meite's off. You know, they've basically got no defenders at this point, Marseille. And there are other players who, you know, on their third match of the season, all demanding different things physically from them, who I think just running on empty. Their season obviously started so early as well because they failed to get in the Champions League through the qualification. So I think they're physically have been struggling a little bit lately. And I think that kind of shows in a few matches. But cup competition across two legs, you never know. They could get the job done over Atalanta. But if they are to do so, we're talking about individuals taking teams to the next level of the season. Aubameyang will be, or will have to be, that player again, as he has been so often, the Europa League's top scorer. At this point, not just this season of all time, but also this season as well. So he is having a really decisive impact on their European campaign. He'll have to be at his top form, and you just have to hope that those injuries abate and that the players who are running on empty can just find those performances in potentially three European games to get them a huge trophy, you know, a huge European club, Marseille. It would be great to see them lift a European trophy once again, having gone deep in European competition, you know, semi-finals and finals in recent years as well. So it'd be great to see them take that extra step.
The thing I will take from this, if they can do that, is that Jean-Louis Gasset will have won a European trophy as head coach. And that is something very, very special. I think that gives hope to all your Eric Roy's, your old coaches, your old school guys that are just there that have been plugging away for years and years, and Jean-Louis, he's just, you know, he can get sacked from in the middle of an Africa Cup of Nations, and then 2 months later, 3 months later, be taking a team to it's spectacular. It's yeah. I hope he does it, because he really is one of those people. If you try and picture someone that is football, you come up with something that resembles, I think, in many respects, a sort of a Jean-Louis Gasset. JJ, you mentioned earlier that you'd seen Lille up close and personal recently. We know that aside from your love of Rouge et Bleu, there is the Claret and Blue. And Aston Villa, were up against Lille and Emmy, who did the job against France at the World Cup, did the job against Lille as well in a penalty shootout. Just a quick, I guess, brief wrap-up of the evening, of the experience. You know, the Stade Pierre-Mauroy isn't the most chaleureux, welcoming stadium in the world from my memory of going there in the middle of winter. But what was the atmosphere like? How close did Lille get? And, you know, sum up their campaign briefly for us.
I mean, the atmosphere was fantastic. I think that was the real big surprise of the day. Obviously went there with Villa 2-1 up, so hopeful of a relatively smooth passage into the semi-finals. It was anything but. I mean, Lille played Villa off the park. Really would have deserved to have finished the game 2-0. We got very fortunate with, unfortunately for Lucas Chevalier, just the one mistake that he made in an otherwise flawless performance was dropping the ball, which allowed Cash to score with basically one of our only shots on target. But, you know, the Lille players had risen to the occasion created by the fans. A superb atmosphere, I think, that was made all the more hostile by Emi Martinez being between the sticks. And it was evident from the very start when he came out to warm up that he was going to be the target of a lot of abuse. And I think, I mean, you know, when Emi Martinez takes to the field in a penalty shootout, that there's only going to be one outcome. And I think as well for the Villa fans, it kind of, you know, you almost feel like it's, you know, an extra goal scored in a situation like that when you've got him between the sticks. And the fury of those Lille fans having to get the armed police behind the goal after he'd saved the first penalty. And I mean, I feel sorry as well for Benjamin André, obviously the unfortunate second player to be denied by Martinez from the spot, who'd scored a lovely header earlier in the game. You know, but I think it was not necessarily the best game, but certainly in terms of experiences, sort of the drama that a penalty shootout brings, it was superb. And the Lille fans can hold their heads high as well. You know, I don't think that Lille had anything to be ashamed of over the two legs. Performed really well, arguably deserved a bit better in the first leg as well with the chances that they created. And that's why I'm tipping them to finish in the top three at the end of the season, because I think what I saw from them against Villa over the two legs, now that they don't have the semi-final and the European distraction, to take their mind off of things that are going on in Ligue 1, I really think that they could finish, you know, in the top three. And obviously, depending on what happens in that game with Monaco, could even potentially have a shot at sneaking the top two.
JJ, a quick question for you. And Luke, I guess being on the Côte d'Azur, it's a little bit different. But back in the old days, and I'm talking, you know, the sort of 90s, early noughties, there were always English fans that were a little disenfranchised with the Premier League or the way English football was going, or even, you know, perhaps it dates to earlier than that, in the mid-80s or something, when European football was banned for English clubs after Heysel. There were always English fans coming across to go and watch Lens play, or you could get the ferry down and go and watch Guingamp as well. I remember running into an Englishman who said he had a group of mates that four or five times a year would always come and watch Guingamp play. There were regular English going to watch Lens. It's even closer now with the Eurostar. I mean, I don't know what the prices are like, but, you know, is it worth the trip, you reckon, to head to Lille? Lille's a great town. I've got friends that and relations that live there, and it's, you know, it's got to be a fun night. I saw some fairly drunken videos of villains around the town, which probably, you know, is not necessarily the way you need to do it, but it's a good day out, and it's a very reasonable day out for an English fan to come across and do, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And any beer connoisseurs out there will absolutely love a day or a night in Lille. You know, you get a fantastic array of different tipples, and that's something that we definitely enjoyed in the build up to the game and a little bit afterwards as well. So some fantastic 10% beer on offer just in front of the stadium. So yeah, I think that contributed towards the experience, we can say. But no, it is a great sort of away day to do, and I'd say it sort of extends as well to Belgium. It doesn't surprise me that sort of some English fans maybe got a taste for sort of like Northern France, because in terms of the style of football and the stadiums, it is very sort of similar. It's well aligned with what English fans are used to. You get fantastic atmospheres at Lens, Lille, occasionally depending on the game. But also, you know, some of those other, like you mentioned as well, Guingamp, and again, another very typically English stadium. I think certainly one of the more cozy venues that the top two tiers in France offer. So absolutely recommended. And if anyone hasn't done it yet, yeah, they definitely should.
Well, very few players have ever been as closely identified with one aspect of the game as Brazilian midfielder Juninho Pernambucano was for his free kicks at Olympic Lyonnais. Johan Cruyff had his famous turn. Zizou had the roulette and Ronaldo Fenomeno had the elastico. But were they the only ones who could do their particular thing? After all, Maradona had a fairly serviceable roulette as well. Ronaldinho was no slouch with the elastico. And were they able to repeat it on an alarmingly regular basis and score a world record 77 free kick goals in the process? Well, I'm not so sure. Well, thanks to his patented technique, Juni, as he was adoringly referred to by the Lyon fans, was unparalleled with the dead ball and unleashed a reign of terror on French and European goalkeepers for 8 long years, regularly hammering home devilishly bobbing and dipping free kicks from 30 to 40 metres out. And Lyon, well, they racked up 7 successive Ligue 1 titles to become regulars in the Champions League knockout rounds as well. Monsieur le Professeur Andreas Evagora has more on this undisputed Ligue 1 legend.
The free kick has been a central part of football since the sport's rules were codified more than 150 years ago. And since then, no player has done more to capitalise on the dead ball than a legend of Ligue 1, Juninho. The former Lyon captain scored more goals from free kicks than any other player on record. Beyond that, the Brazilian revolutionised the art of free kick taking, influenced a generation, and reduced many a goalkeeper to a quivering wreck. In the 1990s, Juninho Pernambucano first built a cult reputation after some stunning free kicks for Rio de Janeiro giants Vasco da Gama. There he was nicknamed the Rezinho da Colina, or King of the Hill. In Europe, the player became as well known for his work in the courtroom as on the football pitch. He was the first Brazilian to sue his club to become a free agent. Juninho won the case and European giants moved in. Under the radar, Lyon's Brazil scout Marcelo urged the initially hesitant club president Jean-Michel Aulas to make an offer. Marcelo finally convinced his boss, but Juninho knew little of Lyon, who at that time had never won the French title. That was when the club's three Brazilians, Edmilson, Claudio Cassapa and Sonny Anderson, were enlisted as middlemen, 0-1. What happened over the next 8 seasons exceeded all expectations. Juninho was made Lyon captain and was the catalyst for an unprecedented run of success at the club. 7 consecutive league titles, still unmatched by any club in France. The free kicks were a key part of that success. Of his 100 goals in 8 years at Lyon, the Brazilian scored an incredible 44 direct from free kicks, including 10 in the Champions League. Goalkeepers in France and Europe were initially surprised at the ferocity, curve and dip of Juninho's dead balls. But try as they might, the free kicks never got any easier to stop. The player's best seasons were in 2004-05 and 5-06. He scored 8 in each of those campaigns. A European reputation was fuelled after a Champions League free kick at Bayern Munich in 2003. Facing Juninho was Oliver Kahn, back then regarded as the best keeper in the world. As Juninho prepared the kick, Kahn barks at his wall and looks edgy. The kick is 35 metres out, surely too far to beat the great German stopper. But Juninho rifles the ball into the net. Kahn crashes into a post and left desolate as the ball bobbles behind him.
Ouais, il est bien parti. Ouais, oh, quel but! Quel but de Juninho à la 5e minute.
As the legend grew, perhaps most surprising was that keepers knew what was coming, but had no power to stop the free kicks. One tough league game at Ajaccio in 2006 was deadlocked at 0-0. Lyon won a free kick fully 41 metres from goal. Homekeeper Stefan Parato prepared himself. Juninho had scored 2 free kicks in the previous 10 days.
Coup franc de Juninho!
But the hapless Parato was left flailing as the ball went left, right, and suddenly dipped into the net. The keeper left on his knees, eyes and palms to the skies, not quite knowing what had just happened. Opposing teams also did their best to stop the Juninho machine. In the noughties, home teams in Liga chose the match ball. Marseille picked a heavier ball for one match against Lyon, Saint-Étienne a lighter ball than the one used at Lyon's Stade Gerland. Both tried to thwart Juninho and both failed. So how did Juninho do it? Top free kick takers of the day like Zinedine Zidane and David Beckham used their instep to hit the ball up and over the wall. Not so Juninho, who developed the technique of knuckleball, striking a football so that it did not spin in flight. Knuckleball makes the ball move, dip and wobble in the air, creating a nightmare for even the best goalkeepers. Such is Juninho's craft that it has inspired academic research. Leading Los Angeles-based sports scientist Dr. Rajpal Bra noted that Juninho would always have a consistent routine, starting three paces back from the ball, or four if the free kick was further from goal. After that, the run-up would change depending on the placement of the ball. For instance, the further left the ball was, the more perpendicular the run-up would become. Each step would have a specific purpose, culminating in Juninho's weaker left foot rotating externally and shifting away from the hips to generate power. Dr. Bra also notes Juninho would hold his torso upright at the moment of impact, using what he calls a dorsal distal top of the foot striking technique. Whatever the science, Juninho's record is unmatched, a record 77 career goals from free kicks, seven more than the legendary Pelé. That left a legacy that's still felt today. Cristiano Ronaldo closely studied the Juninho technique. So did Italian great Andrea Pirlo, who worked ceaselessly on hitting a ball that could rapidly drop towards the goal. He called Juninho's method the maledetta, meaning cursed. Juninho is like an orchestra conductor who's been assembled upside down, wrote Pirlo in his autobiography. His batons are held by his feet instead of his hands. A fitting tribute to a football maestro.
JJ, Juninho was obviously a free kick legend. I think he scored 100 goals for Olympique Lyonnais. Almost half of them were free kicks, or there's some incredible statistic about just how good he was with a dead ball. Do any of those really stand out for you in the memory banks of what he was able to do with a set piece? Because I've got a couple that were just astonishing free kicks. And the thing was, and this is where you really know that you have someone of supreme quality, is that you could expect it. No matter how absurd the distance, how absurd the angle, it was like Messi at his pomp or David Beckham around the edge of the area. You just knew wherever he got a free kick in the opposition half, this was dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think everyone's memory who will recall Juninho as a player will immediately go to that sensational free kick against Bayern in the early 2000s. Just incredible. And I think, you know, whether it was a domestic game, whether it was a European game, he was such a menace from those set pieces. But I mean, I also remember Juninho just being part of that incredible Lyon side that crushed all before them. You know, he was very, despite sort of being mainly their sort of set piece maestro, he was very sort of talismanic. He was very emblematic of that dominant Lyon side. And I think when you think of the players most associated with those seven consecutive Ligue 1 victories, you know, Juninho is one of the first on the list. I mean, he was captain for pretty much a big part of that, mm-hmm. that run as well. So, yeah, you know, I think although obviously he was outstanding from the set pieces, I mean, he really was sort of a fixture in sort of, you know, the stars of French football at that time in the early 2000s as well.
That Bayern Munich free kick, I was trying to think which free kick would I choose. That one is just absurd. He's sort of on the side of the penalty box. It's beyond the corner of the penalty box, and it goes so high from an impossible angle and drops. It's the classic knuckleball, like somehow hitting it, and it curls and dips, and Oliver Kahn has absolutely no chance. The other one that I will never forget, I think, was against Penito for Ajaccio, the goalkeeper Penito, and it was literally in the center circle when he hit it, and the keeper has no chance. Like you think to yourself, and we'll see if we can dig out this. It must be on the official YouTube channel. and put the link in there. You think a goalkeeper shouldn't be beaten from that kind of range, from 35, 40 meters out. But he had no chance, and that is truly remarkable.
It's the momentum that he built up in the shot, though. It's like the shot, when it left his foot, would actually be less powerful than the power that it was hurtling into the net with, you know, when it actually arrived.
Well, how did he do that?
Like a cannonball. I think they debated it for a long time, and it was related to sort of hitting the ball on the valve. It's something that I think Cristiano Ronaldo tried his best to replicate, but you know, you just had that technique. Like you said, it was almost like it was patented. You know, people still talk, you know, to this day about Janino sort of as the free kick master when it came to hitting it in that kind of way. I mean, it's almost like a concentrated and polished version of that Roberto Carlos free kick in Tournoi, where the shot would just be more direct. It would sort of swivel and move around in the air, but stay true to its course.
Luke, what do you remember of the great Juni?
Well, I was kind of, as I think everyone else will do after this pod, potentially goes onto the free kick compilations just to see all of them. I mean, I remembered one against Marseille in the Velodrome, the old Velodrome Open, you know, all open. It just, evokes a few memories a little bit. But what I noted kind of actually going through free kick after free kick after free kick is the technique, which, you know, you've got Roberto Carlos, international teammates at the time, and it's a completely different, you know, they get the same results in many ways, but by hitting the ball so, so differently. And it's just extraordinary that you can get the exact same effect, but by hitting it in such a different way. But also how Janino very, very frequently went over towards the side of the goal, you know, that the goalkeeper was already on, beaten, you know, so precise in getting it in the top corner of the side that the goalkeeper is already on. I mean, the reason that's going to be is because they know how accurately he can pick out the opposite side. So what they tended to do was always take a step to the left, anticipating that. But by the time they've got any time to react, it's already you know, in their near corner kind of thing. But yeah, it was the technique. It was the range of the goals. You know, he could curl it, he could knuckleball it. You know, both corners over the wall, same side of the goalkeeper. There's an incredible array of free kick goals, and that's the living memory for me. Someone who I was in primary school when he was in his pomp at Lyon. So kind of your memories are of those flashy moments and of what you see in compilations and things that you go back to and things that you hear and things that you're told kind of thing. But it's always the same stories that come out whenever you talk about Janino. It's the free kick ability to just strike it in that way and how efficient and effective he was.
Some great kits as well. I was just actually looking up one of my other favorite goals of his, and it was the one against Sedan where he really absolutely hammers it and it just flies into the bottom right-hand corner. Incredible.
You can check out Janino's goals in our pod notes as well. And don't forget to check out League1.com for all the top flight news from France. There's highlights there as well, match previews, stories, features, and it's everything you need to just follow your French football fix. Okay, now, guys, it's time to put your French footballing brains to the grindstone, or whatever other mixed metaphor actually and accurately describes what you do when the déjà vu clue drops. That's right, it is time for the quiz that makes up for its extremely low empathy index by offering you the chance to win a Ligue 1 jersey. All you have to do is tell me which current or former Ligue 1 star I'm talking about, and then send your answer to League1podcast@gmail.com. Here we go. Who am I? Of French and Argentinian heritage, I was born near Paris, but moved to the south of France when I was just 5. A precocious talent, it really wasn't long before I was drafted into a League One youth academy, and then, just a few years later, into the first team squad, where I was immediately finding the back of the net. In the end, I played for 3 Ligue 1 clubs and have played for 3 in the country I currently play in. Unfortunately, my excellent club career has so far failed to bring silverware or senior international football, but there's still plenty of time for that. Who am I, and what 21st century Ligue 1 record do I hold? So there we go. If you have it, send your answers to League1podcast@gmail.com, and you too could go into the running for that splendid Terram Moffey Nice jersey. Luke, you're looking like you might just have a little clue or two. Was down in the south of France.
It feels easy.
Strangely
it feels
familiar.
Easy, but yeah, strangely familiar. It's on the tip of the tongue, but it will not come to me.
JJ,
sure I'll be thinking about that long and hard.
You've had a bit of form recently.
I'm tempted. I have an idea or two.
Okay, very good. Well, get your answers in, and producer Stephen will then put all the correct ones into the hat, and hopefully your name will come out and that Terram Moffey Nice jersey will be on its way to you. We'll announce the winner in 2 weeks' time on the next pod. Okay, so time to wrap things up, gentlemen, and time to look ahead to three matches of round 29, which I mentioned at the top of the program, and then rounds 31 and 32. Very, very quickly, gentlemen, I'm just going to ask for one-word answers for round 29 because that's on this Wednesday. Lorient versus Paris Saint-Germain. JJ, in one word, who wins?
PSG.
Luke?
PSG.
Yes, I agree. Paris Saint-Germain. Marseille versus Nice in the derby on the Mediterranean. Luke, big one, this one.
Draw.
JJ?
Draw.
I'm going to go Nice, not because I'm a Paris Saint-Germain fan at heart, but just feel Marseille, they're coming off a bit of a high, and Nice maybe just showing a little bit of form. It's a big match for them. Monaco versus Lille. Now, this is a massive clash. JJ?
Lille.
Luke?
Draw.
Oh, that's massive. Lille away to Monaco, JJ. I'm going to go Monaco. I think they're finding a little bit of form. All right, now I'm going to give you both a little bit more time to explain the how, what, where, and why. Round 31 next weekend. Massive matches all around now because there's Rennes versus Brest in a Brittany derby. There's Lyon versus Monaco as well. That could decide what happens in the European run. At the other end of the table, Montpellier and Nantes can officially get themselves out of trouble. Big, big games. Marseille versus Lens. Luke, what do you like out of all of this and why?
I think that the Rennes-Brest game is maybe the most enticing one there. Both have a lot to play for. Rennes even haven't shown the best form in Breton derbies this season as well. And I think that Brest will be very, very keen to reaffirm their place on the podium. As we said, we kind of see them potentially going down to fourth. It'll be an incredible atmosphere. Lots on the line for both teams. You'd expect a great match. I mean, another one, of course, the old Monaco is another one to look out for as well. I think Monaco can very much wrap up their podium spot if they do win that. And I think if Lyon don't get a win, I think they can wave goodbye to European football via their league and standing. So, that's a very, very entertaining afternoon, Sunday afternoon in Ligue 1.
JJ, round 32, a week after that, Lyon, having had that opportunity against Monaco, then have Lille. So perhaps even from eighth on the table in a cup final to come, Lyon could yet be deciding who's playing Champions League football. There's also Nice versus Paris Saint-Germain. I'm sure Paris Saint-Germain will be looking for a little bit of revenge for what happened at the start of the season at the Parc des Princes, because it was Nice that knocked them off the perch. And really, I guess that was the result that really set Nice up for that first half of the season and that excellent performances. There's another Brittany derby, or just about, for Brest against Nantes, the old Breton capital. What do you like in 2 weeks' time?
I mean, I have to say that I'd go for the Lyon game for all the reasons discussed. Obviously, Lyon still being in the hunt for European football, and my conviction that we're going to see Lille really run Monaco close for second spot. So, I think looking at those next three games for Lille, it's really going to be a decisive run for where they finish. I think if they can at least get a point in Monaco, I think they fancy themselves at home against Lyon. And the only tricky one is Metz. You know, if Mikotadze is still on the same hot form that he's on, you know, they maybe get held to a point there. So I think it's going to be as crucial for Lille in terms of their top three hopes as it will be for Lyon in terms of trying to stay in the mix for one of the European spots come the end of the season.
Fantastic. You have been listening to Jonathan Johnson and Luke Entwistle, myself, Robbie Thompson, on Le Beaujeu, the official Ligue 1 Uber Eats podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with all the news and only the news that's worth knowing from the world of French football, whether it be the title race, the relegation battle, European football, we're very pleased to say, right up until the end of the season as well, with Paris Saint-Germain against Dortmund and Marseille against Atalanta. Our undercover Frenchman, Baptiste Reynaud, is going to turn back the clocks as well to when Paris Saint-Germain were looking for survival more than trophies in the French top flight as he takes us for a trip down memory lane in one of our features. We're going to announce who has won that signed Terran Moffey jersey as well, and we'll have our first clue for you to perhaps win a Folarin Balogun AS Monaco jersey as well. But until then, and on behalf of the entire Le Beaujeu team, bon match et à bientôt. Au revoir.